This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Oscar Isaac and Ben Affleck head to the jungle in search of a fortune in Triple Frontier, while John Goodman can't make Captive State captivating on any level. And boy, do I mean that last part. And so I'm going to get things started with Captive State. Ryan wasn't able to see it, but so I had to suffer through this baffling, absolutely baffling movie that completely bombed at the box office. And boy, do I have a lot to say. You know, safe to say, you know, just starting off, you know, it's a thoroughly mediocre alien invasion tale that probably has something to say, but gets muddled in what's just a really unengaging, really generic story. But I'm going to read the IMDb synopsis for you, and then I'm going to put I'm going to add a bit of an aside to it. But essentially, this is what the synopsis says. Set in a Chicago neighborhood nearly a decade after an occupation by an extraterrestrial force, Captive State, and this is my addition, claims to explore the lives on both sides of the conflict, the collaborators and dissidents. And I'm sure you guys know from listening to this from our history, Ryan's so good at summarizing films, and because I was the only one who saw this, I had to use the IMDb synopsis, and boy, like, in some movies I may have been able to come up with a synopsis for myself, but this one, no chance. So, you know, the biggest issue, you know, with the film really is the characters. It's just sort of a bunch of nameless, faceless characters. We don't know anything about them, so why are we supposed to care about, you know, anything that happens? You know, it's just sort of like, and there's sequences where, you know, essentially there's this whole thing where, essentially this is, like that synopsis mentioned, they're essentially moving, this is essentially taking place a decade after the aliens initially invaded Chicago. So it's sort of a post-apocalyptic place, and we're following Ashton Sanders of Moonlight fame, as well as John Goodman, who's some government type, although man, does his storyline go off the rails in this one. But it's just a really, like I said, it's hard to know what Rupert Wyatt, and for those of you who don't know, director Rupert Wyatt, who made this, you know, it was mostly, he broke through in a big way with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then went on to make a film, The Gambler, which I enjoyed against my better judgment, because it was a film with literally, like, no depth whatsoever. And this one, I say to say, is the bottom of the barrel as far as his filmmaking career goes, because, like I said, it's hard to know exactly what his intentions are. There's definitely some political intrigue in here. There's definitely trying to make some sort of statement on society, but I have no clue what that is. And there's, like, this big thrust of the story where there's essentially this terrorist group, I guess you could say, who are trying to, you know, instigate the aliens into leaving, or instigate a war, essentially. And the leader of that group is Ashton Sanders' sort of older brother, who, at the beginning of the story, you know, and, you know, I'm just gonna dive into full spoilers here, because I know no one's seeing this movie, and no one cares. But essentially, the film starts, Ashton Sanders' like older brother, you know, is believed dead. He was the revolutionary head of this terrorist group, and is like, image is like plastered on, you know, walls throughout the city and stuff like that. And then it's revealed that, oh, he's alive, and like John Goodman has some connection. He's sort of overseeing Ashton Sanders, and we're not really sure why. And safe to say, the movie just, like, it's just, you never know what to focus on. And then, so it starts with that story, and then we just sort of move off to characters who we have no introduction to. There is my boy James Ransone, or as I'll always call him, Ziggy from The Wire season 2. But he is he's given a thankless role where he's sort of, you know, bringing up this team of terrorists who have to set off this, you know, bomb, I guess, to instigate this war. Like I said, it's hard to know. Like, the opening credits are just like a bunch of like random interspersed expositional text in between sort of the credits, and I couldn't catch all of it, and it was hard to know exactly, you know, what was going on at times. But essentially, like I said, they start with Ashton Sanders and John Goodman, and we assume, oh, these are the characters we're going to be following, and then there's these long extended sequences of these random people who we've never met. Like, you know, it's sort of like a game of, you know, telephone, where someone makes a signal and someone in another place of the city is doing something else, and it's sort of this chain of events. And I'm like, but why am I supposed to care? I don't know these people. I don't know, have any connection to them. I don't exactly know what their message is, other than, you know, I don't know, trying to instigate a war with aliens, I guess, is the intention. But I just found the movie, like I said, really muddled. It's really hard to know what to focus on. You know, John Goodman is essentially just John Goodman. He isn't really given any real material to sink his teeth into. And man, did they waste Vera Farmiga in this film. She's in, like, you know, a couple scenes, and good God, just wait till I get to the ending of this film, because it is just completely nuts. But Vera Farmiga, it's really weird. She's playing sort of, she essentially is playing a hooker who John Goodman, you know, goes to sort of visit in his free time, and then at the end it's revealed that she has some over big connection to the story, even though it doesn't feel completely earned in any way. It's a really weird weird cast. Machine Gun Kelly, of all people, is playing the friend of Ashton Sanders, our presumed lead. But like I said, the film takes many detours, and then we just sort of lose track, and we don't really know whose story this is anymore. You know, and this is the thing about the film. It's not terrible. When I was watching it, it's not like I was seething with rage and being like, oh my god, this is so bad. You know, on the surface level, on the basic surface level, you know, there's some interesting production design. I did kind of like the design for the aliens is definitely something I haven't really seen before. But then, you know, if they change in the course of the movie, I don't know. It's hard to describe, but it seems to go off the rails even with some of those design elements later on in the film. But, you know, this film is really just proof that an ending does not a movie make. You know, I alluded to it, but essentially the movie, it tries to have one of these things, you know, tries to have like a twist ending when the film, when, you know, the audience has no clue that there's even, like, a mystery in this. Like, and this is the thing. It's okay to have, you know, something, a twist come from out of nowhere, and the audience, you know, has no concept of it. But when it's not earned in any way, and when you try to impose meaning on everything that preceded it, but there was nothing that actually really built up, and there was nothing that the audience could actually connect to, that's the definition of an unearned ending. And so it's one of these endings that tries to, oh, look, we have a twist, look, everything was connected, everything has a meaning, could you believe this character did that? You know, yeah, I guess I can, because I don't know who this character is, you know? It was just a really, you know, an ensemble of really wasted talent. Is what I would say. You know, Ashton Sanders, for presumably being the lead, he gets very little to do, and like I said, there's these sequences where we just sort of move off to other things, but, you know, and, you know, I alluded to the fact that there's these sequences where we're following along these random people, and it's just sort of, and you know, as an idea, initial idea, you know, it's not a terrible concept, and they're actually on a filmmaking level in terms of cinematography and stuff, it's well executed, but there's just nothing there to connect to, you know, and it's just basically this is one of these movies that really just comes down to the simple fact that we just don't care about anything that's happening. We're not given any reason to care. So I was just sort of like just watching it, letting it wash over my eyes. There were some cool visuals, you know, here and there, but it is funny because you can tell that the budget on this movie wasn't, you know, that great, because there are a couple of shots that feel like clearly reuse of an alien ship going off into space. So I thought that was, I actually thought that was pretty funny. But, you know, and I can assume, you know, this movie wasn't made for a big budget, because, man, I hope not, because man, is it bombing at the box office, and man, has nobody seen this movie except me. But, you know, I like to think, you know, I was sitting in that cinema, you know, just to take one for the team, and boy, did I ever, because Captive State, it's just not a good movie. But, you know, it's one of these movies that, like I said, you know, on the surface, you could watch it and just sort of not think anything of it if you're not really paying that much attention to. But obviously, we try to look at it with a critical lens. And boy, does this film fall like a house of cards when just looking at it through a critical lens.
The only thing I have to add to that is that I saw Machine Gun Kelly in that movie Nerve with Dave Franco and Emma Roberts, and he is a pretty capable actor, so go figure. So I think we should transition into, we haven't done a news segment in a while, minus our kind of like Oscars post, whatever you want to call that. But we want to talk about some of the trailers, because my God, have they been getting dumped left and right. And I guess we should probably start with the best trailer that came out this week, and it is the sequel to the only TV series that we've ever reviewed on the podcast, and that would be Stranger Things 3, which sees the Hawkins, Indiana gang just growing up and being adorable teenagers, and it's summertime, and Steve has a job in fast food, and oh lordy, this just looks like a blast. I mean, your mind is probably already made up on Stranger Things. If you're a fan of this, I can't see how this didn't get you excited for it. This is, you know, TV is a very different realm for me. I usually overlook a lot of the flaws just because I'm having so much fun and I'm following these characters, wherein if you get an episode that doesn't really click with you, it doesn't really matter, because whatever comes next is going to be that much more fun. And honestly, Stranger Things falls into that camp for me. And it is not camp, actually. I mean, there are certain elements that are definitely played up for the 80s cheese, but it never plays it any less sincerely. I mean, these are guys that the Duffer brothers are actually trying to make something that's really emotionally resonant, and in a way it is. I mean, you know, my childhood was very much unlike what these kids are going through on the show, and I'm not even talking about the paranormal aspect or the sci-fi aspect. It's just, it's still cool to see these kids interacting. It's just so much fun. I'm a sucker for kids that swear too. I mean, it just makes it that much more entertaining for me. But I know that you had a very strong reaction to this trailer as well.
Oh yeah, well, I've watched it about 50 times, so since it's been released. So it's no you know, exact surprise that I'm really pumped for this. You know, I loved both seasons really completely. And I'm really pumped just to see, you know, there's something about that trailer. They're just really, it's both like really exciting, but it's also tinges at the heart. You know, these kids are growing up, obviously. So we're at that stage now, and the kids are starting to look awkward as all hell. And it's actually really fun. You know, I know a lot of people were like, oh, the kids are so cute in season one, and now they're starting to grow up. Oh, whatever. No, you know, that's what, you know, I think that's what's so relatable about the series, you know, getting to see these kids grow up, obviously, just like all of us human beings have done, you know, throughout our lives. Gee, who would have thought? But, you know, I just thought the trailer, it was just so engaging. I love that they're taking on a different time of the year, summer. That could be really great, just, I think, a really nostalgic time. And I'm just happy that it's getting released on 4th of July. You know, it's going to be really, it's just going to be a really fun experience throughout the summer, just to have that time, and I'll probably end up watching it multiple times, so, you know, to be honest, because, like, I have the previous two seasons, but, you know, I'm really pumped, and, you know, I think Stranger Things is one of those things, and I think, for me, is just one of those pure joy things that just makes me happy, and, you know, it's safe to say I need that in today's society, to say the least.
How about Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I am, you know, a self-avowed non-Tarantino acolyte. I find a lot of his stuff absolutely grating. I even passed out on The Hateful Eight. Just for some reason never got around to it and in the theater, and then just never had enough of an interest to follow through. But I got to admit, I know this is just a teaser and there really wasn't much of way in the way of story, but I just found the tone of this really fun. You know, Brad Pitt and Leo, and Leo's pulling, doing a little bit more of his cheeky comedy that he's so good at and so underrated with. And I you know, we were talking about this before we even started recording, and you were just saying how there really wasn't much to grasp onto. That's totally fine, because I guess this is just such a deviation from what I'm used to from Tarantino, that this almost seems like he's letting his hair down in a way, and that could yield very, very fun results instead of just, you know, these super dark stories or the, you know, the spaghetti westerns or World War II rewriting history. It's just fun to see him getting back to something that he's just going to sink his teeth into and enjoy on just for the sake of having fun.
Yeah, and I'm definitely excited to see, you know, that particular era of Hollywood on screen. I think it's just something that, you know, it's hard not to be nostalgic for, even though obviously, you know, we weren't living during that time, but obviously as being big film buffs and being big fans of films of that era and just having, you know, different images from that era in your mind. You know, I think the teaser trailer definitely did a good job of centering that. But yeah, I think I was a bit underwhelmed from it. And to be completely honest, I think the Stranger Things 3 trailer just took the complete momentum out of it for me, because I watched that and then I watched the Once Upon a Time trailer and I was like, well, one of these is like what gets me much more, just it's sort of more of a jolt to the system, you know, I would say in the Stranger Things case, whereas Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is sort of like, you know, throwing these separate images at it. And I, to be honest, I didn't quite know what to make of it, and I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, it's a teaser, so you know, just sort of giving us a sense, and like you mentioned, that tone. I did really like, particularly the ending sequence of the trailer with Leo and that little girl. I thought that was a really great punctuation to the trailer. But I'll be honest, I wasn't quite sure what to make of this stuff prior to it. But I am interested, because it does seem like something that could be a bit different from Tarantino, and that definitely excites me. Considering, like, I'm one of these people who typically likes the outliers of Tarantino, like Jackie Brown is my favorite, you know, Tarantino movie, whereas most people are like, what? So, you know, that's sort of what appeals to me. And you know what's interesting about this is when the trailer got released, and when obviously everyone was having a lot of fun with the memes based on that incredibly terrible poster for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But, you know, I was actually doing some self-reflection and thinking about, you know, my perspective on Tarantino. And obviously you mentioned you're not the biggest Tarantino fan. And like I've said in the past, you know, I wouldn't say I am either. He's not one of my absolute favorite filmmakers, although I will say I've enjoyed the overwhelming majority of his films, and I do recommend checking out The Hateful Eight for a couple of performances in particular, Samuel L. Jackson and my man, Walton Goggins, who is one of the leads of that film in a really unexpected way, and I think he's a great joy to it. But I would say, you know, Hateful Eight is one of my, you know, lesser favorite of Tarantino's, although it's definitely one of those pure Tarantino experiences. But getting back to what I was sort of alluding to, you know, I was doing some self-reflection and thinking about what is it about Tarantino that I don't personally, you know, connect to, and I was just thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I think I know what it is. I think it's because, you know, I have a hard time seeing myself as any of his characters. And that's not to say, you know, that you know, a film can't just be entertaining on a level and you have to connect to a character in everything you see. But I was just really thinking about that and how, like, you probably noticed from listening to me on this podcast, I am always particularly concerned with how characters are portrayed because they're sort of the medium through which, you know, us, the audience, sort of see the story and experience the journey of the story. And I feel like with Tarantino, I feel like he creates these really wild characters, but I have no connection to these people. I would never, you know, be spending time with them in my everyday life. It's fun to watch them. But that was just something I just wanted to mention because I thought it was an interesting observation with some of the self-reflection I was going through this week.
Yeah, I'll certainly have more to say about Tarantino in general once this film actually comes out. I don't want to divert the entire podcast because I could probably write a dissertation on this. But I guess we'll talk about the final big trailer that was released this week in Toy Story 4. And so, you know, Toy Story 3, maybe I was in the minority on this where it didn't hit me quite as hard as it did everyone else. Andrew's shaking his head at me in disbelief right now. And I deserve that, sure. This trailer didn't really do much to sway me back in that direction. Like I said, my childhood wasn't exactly as, like, super happy-go-lucky, so a lot of these types of things kind of fall flat to me. Maybe I just, like, kind of force myself to grow up too fast, and that's why Toy Story doesn't resonate with me the way that Coco, which is entirely centered on death for some reason, resonates with me. Go figure. Read into that what you will. I'll talk about the technical merits of the filmmaking, because Toy Story, after all, was the first entirely feature-length CGI animated film, and you know, I mean, they've got it down to such a science at this point, and it's weird how there's this refinement to it, but it still looks like Toy Story. I'm glad they're not just completely abandoning like the visual palette to it, because that's what was so entertaining about those films in the first place, at least for me. And I'm a big home theater geek too, so it always sounded good in my surround sound system growing up. I don't know, there really wasn't much to latch onto this for me. I like the existential dread in that little Spork character that they're introducing. But beyond that, it's Toy Story, and you probably already made up your mind about that too.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely one of those people who was completely emotionally wrecked by Toy Story 3. I couldn't tell you the last time I had that emotional reaction to a particular sequence, and you guys know exactly the sequence I'm talking about in a film. And to be honest, I am definitely in one of those people in the camp that I thought, where can you go from Toy Story 3? I thought it was such a perfect send-off, you know, to the series that I am a bit worried about Toy Story 4. You know, I think the trailer, you know, I definitely had some fun with it. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, I was like over the hill with it. You know, I know you mentioned that Spork character. I'll be honest, I'm a bit worried about that. It feels like such a weird thing, you know, in a Toy Story movie. And I know Tony Hale, I think, is playing that character, which is a perfect choice for something like that. But I just wasn't entirely sure what to make of it. I did like, you know, how there, it seems like there's going to be a bit of a carnival setting to it, which I think is really great, which is ironic because Stranger Things 3 is also has some carnival to it, and I admit I am a sucker for amusement parks in general, so that's something that I definitely connect to on that level. But I really didn't know what to make of it, although I did want to mention that I am pumped for one particular element of the film that hasn't really been given away yet, and that is that Keanu Reeves apparently is playing the villain of the story, and so I think that's a really intriguing, and from some of the stories I'm hearing, it's going to be a pretty wild character, so I'm really pumped for that element in particular. But the truth is, Pixar has such a good track record, it's hard to, you know, be like, oh man, that's gonna be crap, you know, and I don't think it is gonna be crap. I'm sure it'll be solid to fine, you know. I just hope it still brings that emotional resonance that was just, you know, so such a big part of that original trilogy. But then just sort of as a last note for this news section, I did just want to mention that, speaking of Keanu Reeves, Bill and Ted Face the Music, I believe is what it's supposed to be called, is actually going to happen. The third Bill and Ted movie. And, you know, I was talking to Ryan about the Bill and Ted series before. You know, it's interesting because I know most people of our age, you know, saw these films, you know, at a young age and sort of have the nostalgia for it. I will admit that I didn't see them until actually just a few years ago. And I have to say, I was really enjoyed them. And I know there's many films of that era that wouldn't necessarily hold up. But I thought both of the Bill and Ted films have such this weird energy to them. That's just really fun to watch and not take too seriously, and I think it could be really fun to see just see Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves playing these adults in a very modern context. I think that just could be a really joy to watch, and it'll be fun to see Keanu Reeves get out of you know, action star mode, although come on, Keanu Reeves as John Wick. And speaking of, there was the latest trailer for that dropped today, and good God, the insanity is real, and I can't wait for some of the most insane action on screen ever, to say the least.
I haven't seen the Bill and Ted movies at all, actually. I never saw them as a kid growing up. I mean, I watched The Thin Red Line when I was 12 years old, just to kind of give you an idea of where my mindset was back then. It's just, I mean, it's going to be goofy comedy. I totally trust the team behind it, and I know that it is regarded as something that's actually genuinely funny. It's a broad comedy, but it still has clever humor, and that's something I can get behind. So I'm going to withhold all judgment. I'll catch up on those sequels later on the originals. Well beforehand, just so I'm kind of primed, so I know exactly what I'm getting into. But and I'll also get caught up with John Wick as well, just because I know I'm slacking on that. It's just the dog dies in the first 5 minutes. That's a hard sell for me. I'm a softie. I know. But I think, is that all the news that we had this week? I mean, it was a long one, but I think we can finally transition into, my God, this is the third Netflix movie that we've reviewed already this year. They're just pumping these out. And it's with good directors, too. So, hey, go figure. Good on you, Netflix. All right. My heart breaks on this one. We're going to talk about J.C. Chandor's Triple Frontier. And J.C. Chandor is a guy that I am a massive, massive, massive fan of. And it was co-written by Mark Boal, who I am also a massive, massive fan of. So I don't know at what point some wires got crossed that led to me being so underwhelmed and bored by this movie. I don't know. It just broke my heart. But basically, it centers around this team of it's Ben Affleck, Oscar Isaac, Garrett Hedlund, the other one who looks like his brother. Why am I blanking?
Charlie Hunnam.
And you know what? They're cast as brothers in this film. I always confuse the two. We record the episode of Lost City of Z before we even started this, and I confused them. I was calling him Garrett Hedlund for half the fucking interview, and Andrew didn't correct me. And I always confuse them. So this is brilliant casting on their part, and they're both very good in this film. And Pablo Pascal of Game of Thrones fame as well. And I believe he's on Narcos too, if I'm not mistaken. So hey, go figure on that. He's in another drug running movie. But basically, Oscar Isaac is this former mercenary who's down in South America. It's not really specified what country, although it's probably like Bolivia or Ecuador, giving on where they're crossing over which borders. And he's basically going after this drug kingpin who's hauled away in the jungle, and he, you know, wants to get the team back together, all his team of mercenaries and warriors played by the aforementioned actors. And it's all this, you know, everyone has a stake in the game. You know, Garrett Hedlund is an MMA fighter, and Ben Affleck is selling real estate, and everything's just falling apart, and they can't even make ends meet. So they all rush to the jungle, and they want to not only take out this guy who's been causing so much violence down there, but take his money and basically live the lives that they're meant to live, or so they think. So I don't know. There's so much of this, especially in the first like 25 to 30 minutes of this film. I feel like it's just the same conversation being held over and over again, especially with Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is a guy I usually like, but he is terrible in this film. He is just such a drag to watch, and he just has like this lethargic, monotonous delivery, and he's just like talking about, oh, I gotta do right by my kid, you know, one last job, and wink, wink. And it to the point where it almost feels like a 90s action film in some ways. And that's not necessarily a terrible thing at times. There are a couple cool sequences, you know, when they're trying to take the money and escape with the money on a helicopter and trying to fly over the Andes Mountains. And there is some, I guess, well-staged action sequences. The camera work is very good, and the sound work is very good as well. But this, I don't know, something about it just, like, it never got out of second gear for me. I was just not interested in the characters or their stories. I really like, and I'm not just saying this because I only remember his name, but Garrett Hedlund was probably my favorite part in the film. He just had like this kind of like a smirking cowboy energy to him that everyone else was lacking, frankly. So that was just an injection of energy for me. The dialogue was just like so heavy-handed and overwrought, and it was wearing on me because I wanted it to. The film does have something to say at the end of it all, and it's a moral that I guess is the logical conclusion for the story. So, you know, kudos on them for actually going the right way from a moral ambiguity standpoint here. But at the end of the day, it's just something that I really wish was better. There's some solid action, and you're probably not going to be bored to tears per se. But it's really, given the talent involved, I was just wanting so much more.
I like how you characterized Hedlund's character as a cowboy, because that's pretty much the character he plays in every movie. Don't get me wrong, I think he's good at it. I just wanted to make that clear. I think I definitely enjoyed the film a bit more than you did. I will say it's definitely not on the level of any of J.C. Chandor's previous work. I know both of us were massive fans of A Most Violent Year. I think one of the most underseen films in recent years, and that definitely gets the biggest recommendation I know from both of us, starring both Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain, and really great, fantastic performances. performances. And honestly, I think I enjoyed Oscar Isaac the most in this film. I think I'll be honest, I think the thing about Oscar Isaac is I think he's so good that it doesn't matter, you know, what he's speaking or something. He just has that engaging presence on screen. And I think that's sort of what I felt in the film. You know, I think it's, you know, just sort of a kind of watchable, you know, I was never bored at any point in the film. And I think, you know, I was telling Ryan this, I think if he sat through Captive State, he'd probably look at Trevor Frontier in a bit of rosier lens, to say the least. But I just thought it was a kind of, you know, one of these watchable sort of old school action parables, obviously about typical, you know, things like the cost of, you know, crime and greed and stuff like that. And I will say that's one of the elements I felt like J.C. Chander was not very subtle in his messaging. In fact, I think it's towards the end where Garrett Hedlund even has a line which pretty much just spells it out, just sort of out loud. And I think that was one of the elements that I definitely had an issue with. But I have to admit, I actually did, you know, I just sort of thought it was watchable. You know, it's sort of like one of these, I would say it's, you know, if I was going to rate it on like a scale of 10, I would give it like a 6, where it's like, it's not quite good or great, but it's watchable. And, you know, I personally was never sort of bored during the film. I just thought it was, you know, just watching these characters go through this environment and just sort of, you know, just experiencing it on that level. I wasn't completely engaged through a lot of the characters. You know, I think they definitely could have did a bit more work with Hedlund, Hunnam, and Pascal's characters in particular. Although I did want to mention the hat that Pedro Pascal is wearing is a reference to A Most Violent Year, so the J.C. Chandor cinematic universe is real. You know, I really thought, you know, it's interesting, you know, you bring up Affleck. I think, you know, Isaac and Affleck's characters are the only ones who are at least given, you know, some characterization or something, but as you mentioned, and I'm glad you brought this up because I had it in my notes as well, I think Ben Affleck's new acting style is just every subsequent movie he makes, he looks more tired as it goes, as every movie that gets released. So soon enough, we're going to see Ben Affleck on screen. He looks like he's going to be sleeping, I assume. Because he really did. Because you're definitely not wrong in the sense that he definitely looked like, what? Like I said, I seriously think this is just his new acting style. No joke. Like, because I've seen it, you know, I saw it in Justice League. You know, I had mentioned, you know, previously that the only thing I even liked about Batman vs. Superman was Ben Affleck. And then he gets around to Justice League, and then he's like looking as tired and miserable as ever. You know, I'm not one for conspiracy theories, but I'm going to say, gee, I wonder how this trend started. Gee, it couldn't have been Ben Affleck being cast as Batman and then being miserable at the quality of the films he was in, could it? Gee, I wonder. Not really much of a mystery there, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, I mentioned, you know, some of Chandor has, some of his messaging is a bit on the nose here. But I will say, I thought there was some, you know, interesting sequences, at least visually. I thought there's some really nice photography. There's that, you know, burning money sequence, which on the surface, in terms of messaging, is certainly ridiculous. But it's a scene that's punctuated with a really incredibly visual shot sort of at the end. So it's sort of like one of those things where sometimes the messaging just isn't there, but I, you know, but because the visuals just sort of punctuate it well, I was sort of willing to forgive some of these lesser moments. But like I said, you know, I don't think it's a particularly good movie, but I thought it was solid to watchable. You know, it's not anything, you know, when I was watching it, much like Captive State, I wasn't watching this and being like, oh man, that's really bad. It's just sort of like, it's just sort of there. And I did want to mention probably one of the most disappointing elements for me in the film is that the music from this film is provided by Disasterpiece, the man who literally composed my favorite score of the past decade for It Follows. And here, it seems like there isn't much of a score, and then all the music is like just classic rock songs. I thought that was one of the things that I felt like, you know, well, I like some of these songs, it's just so on the nose. It's like, Run Through the Jungle, oh Jesus Christ. Like, I mean, like, it was just like so on the nose. It's just like, it was like almost ridiculous to that point. And I just felt like, you know, a film like this, and you know, I think it's important to note about this, because I know a lot of people won't know this heading into this film, but I think it's important to note about this project that it has been in developmental hell forever. This script has been around forever, and, you know, Mark Boal wrote the original script, and I believe originally it was going to be Kathryn Bigelow, I believe, directing it, which I think would have been a great choice. But I feel like J.C. Chandor, like, on his rewrite, because he got a co-writing credit, I feel like he must have did something to the script, although I'm not going to put solely the blame on him, because I feel like, given a project that went through so many years of development, I feel like at a certain point it was just like, oh, we got the right cast, now we just gotta get it out there. And so I can't really be too hard on them for that level. And I think that's the thing about the film. I had that very much in mind, you know, in watching the film, because I'd always heard about this project and what A-list talent was going to be in. And I believe initially, I think Brad Pitt might have been in the initial cast for this. I don't really remember exactly, but it went through so many different iterations that I'm not exactly surprised that it did end up coming out looking like a bit more of a generic action film at the end of the day.
That's fair enough, and I mean, that's also not enough to change my opinion of the film. I mean, again, just with the expectations of who was attached going in just really kind of deflated me at the end of the day. But I am glad that you brought up the soundtrack to this film, because holy shit, you want to talk about on the nose. There's a scene after there where they're trying to smuggle their money after they've killed people, and where they're just, you know, snaking through the water, and Bob Dylan's Masters of War is playing in the background, For Whom the Bell Tolls is played in one sequence from Metallica, and the Creedence Clearwater song. This is what something that Robert Zemeckis does in every single one of his movies that drives me up the wall. And it's on the nose, it's obnoxious, and it's almost like a disingenuous storytelling. I mean, everyone knows these songs, and it's supposed to be like this tongue-in-cheek thing where it's like, maybe it appeases the middle-brow crowd, where it's like, oh, I know where this is going, I know based on the tone of this song. But it's just, it falls completely flat. You can do better, especially when you have such a great composer on board already. It's just a missed opportunity all around for me. So I just, like, after a certain point, don't get me wrong, I'm glad Netflix is putting all this money behind these films. I know not all of them are going to be winners. God knows that Velvet Buzzsaw wasn't either. But at least that they're trying things and they're taking scripts that were from developmental hell and honestly probably should have been made in a completely different era and giving them new life, because there are people that are still interested in those types of movies. I still love movies like Speed and Twister and Con Air and Air Force One and Face Off. And I feel like maybe in the hands of someone with more of a sense of humor in mind instead of wanting to tell a message, this film might have been more entertaining, but it also probably would have been grossly offensive. So maybe it's just a lose-lose all around.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and for those of you who don't know writer Mark Boal, he's known for, you know, his collaborations with Catherine Bigelow, particularly The Hurt Locker, as well as Zero Dark Thirty, which I think is, you know, a really fantastic film that I think covers material that sort of overlaps here. But I think what's interesting about the story is that I think it's clear Mark Boal had an interesting idea, taking these people who are in their post, you know, military lives, you know, sort of in this place. And I think that might have been something that I connected to on some level, where, you know, there's clearly something there, an idea that I think can be explored in a great way. But like I said, I think over the course of time, I think it just ended up being more of this action thriller and not really, you know, playing to those strengths of Chandor, which I think, you know, are really in, you know, character scenes. And I think, you know, there could have been, even if there was just a few more scenes of these characters, like really hitting home the weight, you know, of this place. You know, there's a few here and there, but not enough to really bring that home to, you know, a full stop. So I really think, you know, there was a good idea here, but I think it just got lost over the course of time, and it may have been, you know, producers pushing the project in one way or another. But yeah, I definitely, you know, look forward to J.C. Chandor's next, you know, foray, because I'm sure, you know, he'll have, you know, because I'm sure, you know, he's made many films, you know, that we are really appreciative of, many films that are very underseen, so I can't recommend, you know, a lot of his work highly enough.
I want to touch upon one of his films, All Is Lost, which came out immediately before Most Violent Year, which starred Robert Redford in a role, honestly, he should have won the Oscar walking away that year, never mind the fact that he wasn't even nominated, but it's basically Robert Redford on a boat for an hour and 40 minutes, and it's just so captivating. He says like five words in the entire, it opens with him reading like what's basically a goodbye note to his family should he never be found again, but he really only says like one or two lines throughout the entire thing, and it's just incredible what Chandor gets out of him in the way that he just uses Redford's not just his charisma but like his dignity, and especially his dignity that comes with age in the face of like something that's like so devastating and terrible. It's basically just this rich guy in his yacht, and the hull of the ship breaks open, and now he has to repair it or else he's going to drown, and he's running out of food and water, and you know where it's going basically. But it's just so brilliant. So honestly, and it's terrifying to watch. You wouldn't think that a movie of this subject matter with minimal dialogue would be as interesting as it is, much in the same way that, once again, Robert Zemeckis, I don't know why this name keeps coming up, but his Castaway from however many years ago now kind of fell flat because I think it dragged out. Some of it worked better, some parts of it worked better than others. It was strong when Tom Hanks was on the island, but I think some of the superfluous stuff didn't quite work for me. So I think with that in mind, Chandor really just kind of hones in on the experiential aspects of the film, and you're with Robert Redford through the entirety from beginning to end of this situation, and it's terrifying and it's galvanizing at the same time, and it's just never anything less than just captivating.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see that. But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, and obviously that film was definitely a very unique experience. One of those sort of, so I mean, not technically single location, but you know, sort of similar in that with that setup. And yeah, that film was definitely something else. But like I'd mentioned, you know, Most Violent Year, I'd definitely check out. And I would even check out Margin Call, which is a film that I will fully admit. That I would say a lot of the dialogue went completely over my head. It's sort of one of these financial, you know, taking place in a skyscraper with its ensemble cast. Although I will say watching that film now might have a different meaning, considering the presence of a certain actor, Kevin Spacey. But, you know, that film I was thought was, you know, really something, you know, wild and, you know, how I would never be into a financial thriller. But J.C. Chandor made me interested. So I think it's safe to say, you know, his career is still in fine shape. But I guess with that in mind, we can transition and turn our attention to next week, where we'll definitely be watching Jordan Peele's Us, which I couldn't be more excited for, as well as Gloria Bell, a remake starring Julianne Moore and John Turturro.
And it's funny, you know, a couple weeks ago we had High Flying Bird on the podcast, and we mentioned how Steven Soderbergh was the most reviewed director. Well, next week, Sebastian Lelio will tie that, even though I did not see A Fantastic Woman. Andrew did speak about it afterwards, and then he had Disobedience come out a few months after the fact. So this would be the third film from Sebastian Lelio, so go figure. Very prolific filmmaker after his big, you know, I don't want to, I'm not using this phrase just because of the, what the movie's about. I was gonna say it's this big coming out party. That's horrible. I'm sorry. I'm just really excited about this upcoming film. I really like Disobedience, and the trailer for Gloria Bell is just, I didn't see the original, but this one does look pretty damn good. But as always, thank you so much for putting up with us, and we'll see you next week.